Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Taking the Bodhisattva Vow by Lama Cathy Wesley. In anticipation of an upcoming Bodhisattva Vow ceremony at KTC, Lama Cathy recalls her own connection to the vow and how our relationship to Dharma ripens and changes over time. Basics about the Bodhisattva Vow will be shared, as well as its place in our Dharma path. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Thanks, everyone, and thank you so much for being here today. It's wonderful to see everyone. I think we'll start today, as we usually do, with the prayer of taking refuge. We'll recite this three times in English to kind of bring our aspiration to this place and make the aspiration that all beings are free from suffering. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Okay, thank you. I'll recite a short prayer of my own, and then we'll begin.
Oh, Paulden Sawe Lama Rinpoche, Tagi Chi War Pede Ten Shula, Kadrin Jembo Gone Che Sunte, Kusum Tugging Udrup Sao to Soul.
Okay, thank you. All right, in any case, good morning, and thank you so much for coming today. Today's talk has a special topic because this afternoon, at the request of a Dharma student, we're going to be offering the Bodhisattva Vow ceremony here in this room about 1:15 this afternoon. So there's always a teaching that precedes this. A teaching is customarily given before the vow ceremony. But because the vow ceremony was put together a little bit at the last moment to meet somebody's work schedule, I wasn't able to plan a separate event. So I said, well, we'll just give today's Dharma talk on the Bodhisattva vow to introduce the topic of the vow and to introduce it to people who may be unfamiliar with it. Those of you who have not heard the Beastie Boys' Bodhisattva Vow track, I can't quote it, so I'm not going to like try because it'll be ridiculous just to hear me do it. It's going to be ridiculous. So, the concept of the Bodhisattva has been around forever. And they popularized it in that track that they made, but the idea has been around for 2,500 years or longer, and really as long as humanity, if you want to put it that way, because the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, he taught 2,500 years ago. He gave his teachings on the Bodhisattva path all those many, many years ago. But really, in a way, he was only expressing in words that which human beings have felt forever, which is that we want to help other beings. We want to be in community with other beings. We want to acknowledge the presence of other beings in our lives and in this world. And we want to be kind. The reason for this, of course, is because there's a practical side, but there's also a spiritual side. The practical side is that being kind brings us goodness. When we are kind to others, others see us as a person who is trustworthy. When we are kind to others, we're seen as stable and dependable, because people who get angry so fast, so easily, sometimes we're afraid of them. Sometimes we're not sure we want to approach them. Sometimes we're not sure if we're going to feel emotionally or even physically safe in the presence of an angry person. Whereas in the presence of a kind and loving person, we feel relaxed. We feel safe. And we actually also might feel cherished and treasured and appreciated. So this is, to me, why the Bodhisattva ideal has been ringing true for at least 2,500 years, and if not, all the way back to the beginnings of humanity, because kindness is very attractive. Kindness is very pacifying, and it can pacify even difficult people. And so, because this kindness is inherent to us, it's part of us, it's part of being human to feel this kindness and this caring. At first, maybe we only feel it for the people in our family, or maybe if we have an interesting life, maybe it's just the people outside our family we feel kindness for, I don't know. But we knowingly enter into relationship with people who we think of as being beneficial and kind. We choose those kinds of people to be around. And these are the kind of people we would like to be. And so when the Buddha started teaching, and he said in one of his lectures, he said, "We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world." He makes a plea for kindness. He gives a reasoning why kindness is so important. He compares two emotional states in the next part of his presentation. He says, if we think, speak, and act with an impure mind, suffering follows us, just as surely the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart. And he says, and if we think, speak, and act with a pure mind, happiness follows us like a shadow that's unshakable. And in these two verses, he gives the rudimentary teachings, his own rudimentary teachings on karma. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. If we think, speak, and act with an impure, meaning a selfish mind, a mind that's only interested in its furthering its own wishes. He said, this brings suffering to us, because most often when we find other people in our way, when we are selfishly pursuing something, if somebody gets in our way, we push them out of the way, sometimes firmly and violently. And we think that we are justified in doing this because we want what we want and we are supreme in this situation. And so he's saying, don't be like that, because suffering will follow you if you're like that. On the other hand, he says, if you have a pure mind, an unselfish mind, a mind that is loving, giving, and caring, happiness will follow you like a shadow that you can't shake. And we all know how it feels to be angry, and we all know how it feels to be how it feels to be selfish. You know, don't want to give anything, how tight we can feel when we're that way. And we also know how it feels when we're giving and generous. Okay, maybe patience doesn't feel so good, but if we're giving and generous, then it's then we can see maybe patience as a form of generosity, being generous with how other people are, you know. Oh yeah, that person's like that. Okay, I can deal with that. So in this way, by giving us these basic teachings, he is encouraging us to feel those two things and then decide which we want. And in fact, he even goes further into the analogy by giving an example of two thought patterns a human being can have. The first one is the selfish thought pattern. So he quotes a person who is thinking these thoughts. Look how that person beat me and abused me. Look how they threw me down and how they robbed me. Well, my goodness. And then he said, live with such thoughts and you live in hate. Then he gives another thought pattern. He says, look how he beat me and abused me. Look how he threw me down and robbed me. And then the Buddha says, abandon such thinking and live in love. Now, we know that in this modern world, it's really difficult to do this. But the Buddha gave all kinds of methodology for being able to do at least even just a small smidgen of that. In the various teachings the Buddha gave on how to be kind and how to be loving, he makes allowances for justice and other types of situations. But the basic thing is, even when you're working for justice, do it in such a way that you preserve your own inner goodness in the midst of seeking justice. So, in other words, the Buddha gave us methods. He gave us a means for practicing this. He gave us a means for learning how to let go of selfishness. And that was part of his teaching. He said, the next part of this section of teaching, he says, well, wait a minute, I want to spend one more minute with that first section. When we are thinking grudge thoughts, you know, like that person hurt me, I'm going to get revenge, or that person did me wrong, I'm going to get revenge, you can see how tight your mind is thinking like that. But you can also think about how it felt for you to be forgiven by somebody else, and for you to be understood by somebody else who misunderstood you, or for you to be helped by someone who you hurt. The difference in the feeling inside your mind, and that's what the Buddha is asking us to think about when we're tight as opposed to being open, when we're giving and loving as opposed to being tight and controlled. So he's encouraging us to choose which one we would like. I know which one I would like, but it's not always easy to do because sometimes people can be very difficult. So in the very last part of this talk, the Buddha says, hate never once dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible. And then he concludes the section by saying, you too shall pass away, meaning we're all going to die. You too shall pass away. And knowing this, how can you quarrel? How can you fight? So he's giving us a choice, but he has also given us a method. Only love dispels hate. That's it. Only love dispels hate. Well, that's a very simple thing to say, but how do you do it? How does love dispel hate? How can it? I mean, isn't hate really strong? Well, in the 8th century, there was a great Buddhist saint named Shantideva. Shantideva lived as a Buddhist monk in a small monastery, I'm sorry, big monastery, in India, and he was thought to not be very smart. And so when it came to be his turn, to give the Dharma talk, because all the monks had to take turns giving the Dharma talk. His peers sought to humiliate and embarrass him. And so they said, when he climbed up on the teaching throne, when he said, "Do you want to hear an old teaching, or do you want to hear something new, an original composition?" They said, "Oh yeah, original composition, please," thinking that this would humiliate him even more if he's speaking his own words rather than the Buddha's words. So he begins to teach on the power of love and the power of compassion. So he starts giving this teaching on the power of love. And he teaches for hours and hours on the power of love. And somewhere near the end, he starts to float above his cushion into the air. And the other monastics said, "Maybe we were wrong about this guy." In the very first chapter of what became of this composition, it was called The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. In the first chapter, Shantideva presents the power of love as being greater than the power of evil. And so he does this using an analogy. He compares the thoughts of goodness that come from human beings as being very brief and fleeting, and he compares it to the flash of lightning in the middle of the night. It just illuminates the world for a moment, and then it stops. And he says, just like that flash of lightning, he said, "Likewise, through the power of the Buddhas, virtuous thoughts arise in this world." Well, that sounds pretty depressing. But if we look at the world today, we could probably get an idea as to how that could be. Because, you know, it's pretty fleeting. There's a lot of bad stuff going on in the world. But this fleeting moment, and in the next verse after that, Shantideva makes his point. He said, "Thus behold the utter frailty of goodness." And then he says, "Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing able to withstand the great and overwhelming force of evil." Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing that can withstand the great and overwhelming force of evil. So only bodhicitta overcomes evil. Only bodhicitta overcomes hate. Only bodhicitta brings love. So what's bodhicitta then? So what's that? The textbook definition of bodhicitta goes back to the root words. Bodhi is awakening. Citta is the mind. So a mind that is awakening, well, what's that mind awakening to? The mind is awakening to its own reality. The mind is awakening to its own nature. The mind is awakening to its own awareness and goodness. The Buddha, when he was teaching, he said, all beings have the capacity to become Buddhas. He said, there's no person who does not possess the capacity to become a Buddha. Okay, circumstances may limit their ability to practice the Dharma, his teachings, and to become a Buddha. Maybe their situation and circumstance may not permit them to train and become a Buddha, but they actually, everyone possesses the potential. And that's why every being, he said, has the capacity to be noble. In the old days, it was thought that you were born to nobility. But these days, people know that because we have a mind that has this amazing potential, we can rise above and be noble, no matter where we're born or how we're born. We can become noble just by knowing our basic nature and really being aware of and one with and nurturing our basic nature. The Buddha said, we call it Buddha nature. We have, and the word used in the old days is Tathagata Garbha. Tathagatagarbha? Tathagatagarbha, yeah. The Buddha mind. Everybody has it. But that Buddha mind is within the mind we have now. You know, the confused one that gets a lot of things wrong. That confused and dualistic and sometimes wandering mind actually has the capacity to know itself and to know itself completely. And that's why the Buddha encouraged all of his followers to do no harm, to practice virtue, and then to tame their minds. Doing no harm calms the mind. Practicing virtue settles the mind. And taming the mind means that one can eventually discover one's Buddha nature and live from that place of basic wisdom and goodness that's within us all. And that bodhicitta is the method for uncovering the Buddha nature. There are two kinds of bodhicitta that the Buddha taught about. One was relative and the other is ultimate. The relative bodhicitta is just love and compassion. I know at first we may only feel love and compassion for our near and dear ones, but eventually we can train our mind to feel love and compassion even for people we don't know or maybe even people who we see as harmful. We can eventually, through training, train our hearts and minds to love all beings. And that's the training aspect of relative bodhicitta. Many people are familiar with the Buddhist practice called metta, or loving kindness. In the metta practice, you sit in meditation and become aware of your breathing, just like in regular meditation. But as you breathe out, you mentally extend love and goodness, first to yourself, then to those who are near and dear to you, and then to all beings in the world, and then even to those who are complex and difficult for you. So in this way, we can gradually rehearse what it must be like to be a Buddha. We can rehearse what it's like to feel love for oneself, to feel love for our dear ones, to feel love for those who are outsiders to us and to all beings. By rehearsing this every day on our meditation cushion, we train ourselves to be more kind and loving. I mean, when we watch athletic competitions like the Olympics on television, we hear the announcers talk about the training athletes undergo. Athletes will train for weeks, months, and years completing their task. Ice skaters, they're beautiful figures. Then people who play, well, the basketball tournament just ended, so people who play basketball, imagine they're putting baskets in the ball in the basket. They visualize successfully hitting a baseball. So if these people can do this, then why can't we mentally train to become more kind and loving? It makes sense. And so that is what the practice of bodhicitta is all about. Bodhi is awakening, citta is mind. Now there's another kind of bodhicitta. There's a relative bodhicitta and there's ultimate bodhicitta. The ultimate bodhicitta is the, how do I describe it? It's an understanding of the nature of everything. It's an understanding of the truth of everything. Many of you who have studied Buddhism before know that the Buddha taught two things about the world and phenomena. He said everything's impermanent. Everything is impermanent. It's always changing. Nothing is permanent. Everything is impermanent. And everything is interdependent. There's no short without long. There's no yes without no. The whole idea is that everything is interdependent and things arise depending on causes and conditions. So if everything is impermanent and interdependent, that means that we can begin to have an impact on that process and we can learn about how that process is and see the true nature of everything, not just our own minds, which are also interdependent and so forth, but all phenomena. Just think of what it would be like if we experienced a loss in our life Let's talk about something simple. You know, we lose something that's valuable and precious to us. Maybe we lose our watch. Maybe we lose something. Wouldn't it be something to be able to think, everything is impermanent, I will have to get another watch, instead of like, oh no, it's a disaster, you know. But if we can figure out that everything is impermanent, we can begin to have a more balanced approach to everything. And coming to understand that in the most deepest way possible, that is ultimate bodhicitta. That's the ultimate Buddha mind. The ultimate Buddha mind is to know the nature of everything as being impermanent and interdependent. Now, some people use the word emptiness, and it's a fine word, but it's a little bit difficult to understand. My teacher said, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, the founder of our center, said the easiest way to understand emptiness is to understand interdependence and impermanence. He said, if you understand impermanence, you'll know that nothing exists of itself or by itself. It just exists in concert with other causes and conditions. I'm sorry, I said impermanence. I meant interdependence. So in this way, if we can learn about love and compassion, it's okay if we don't understand impermanence, interdependence, and emptiness. It's okay because love breaks down barriers. Compassion breaks down barriers. And what else do we need to know about the world, except how to break down the barriers between ourselves and ourselves and ourselves and others and ourselves and everything. So in this way, we can train our mind in love and compassion. But how do we do that? Well, in the Buddhist tradition, we begin our Buddhist practice by taking something called the vow of refuge. We choose Buddha as our teacher, the Dharma as our path, and the Sangha as our community. We choose these as our refuge. Our higher power, if you will, is the Buddha who achieved enlightenment, his teaching for achieving enlightenment, and his community, which is our community, to help us become Buddhas ourselves. And that's the initial entry ceremony for Buddhists. But a person can also then take the vow to train as a bodhisattva. A person can take the bodhisattva vow, saying that they will not just take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but that they will train as the Buddhas of the past have trained, in love and compassion and an understanding of the nature of all things. Relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta. So just as the Buddhas of the past trained in these two kinds of bodhicitta, I will train just as they did. And that's the actual words of the actual bodhisattva vow. Just as the Buddhas of the past engendered the Buddha mind or bodhicitta and practiced stage by stage the bodhisattva's conduct, therefore, for the benefit of beings, I too will generate bodhicitta, this bodhi mind, and I will train and practice. And as they did, I will become proficient. So what's interesting about this is that many people think that you have to already be perfect before you take the bodhisattva vow. But the fact of the matter is, really, only imperfect people need apply. Because it's a vow of training. It's not a vow of instant perfection. It's a vow that I will train as the Buddhas of the past have trained, and I will, as they did, become efficient. It doesn't give a time frame, which I think is really great. In fact, it does give a time frame, but it'll make you smile. The time frame is from now until enlightenment is reached. Okay, that's good. If we had to do it in a couple of weeks, it would be difficult. But we've got all of this life, if you know, I wouldn't put it off too long, but you know, we've got all of this life at the very least, and if you believe in past and future lives, we've got a few more. But what he meant by this is that from now until we become Buddhas ourselves, we want to train just like this. We want to become like the Buddhas of the past. We want to become kind and loving and completely understand the nature of everything. That's what we want. We want to be like that. And what this means, of course, is that we're going to have to check up on this kind of on a daily basis. So this is why once a person takes the Bodhisattva vow, they're encouraged to use their meditation practice and the mindfulness that their meditation practice gives them to check up on themselves every day and see, how's my Bodhisattva vow going? Everybody knows about this. I have a timer on my watch, and it goes off every day at 4 p.m. Eastern. Anyway, but it goes off at 4 p.m., and it says, how's your Bodhisattva vow going? How's it going? And I check up on myself in that moment. And I say, well, how have I done today? Have I been kind to myself? Have I been kind to others? Or do I need a little help with that? Do I need to improve that a little bit? And pursuing that kind of awareness and pursuing that kind of training is how we become a Bodhisattva. Day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, just checking up on ourselves. I don't mean obsessively. I mean as we think of it, as it comes up to us, although it might come up for us in ways we don't expect. My teacher used to say, oh, a lot of people go to their teachers and they say, oh, teacher, please tell me my worst faults that I may correct them. They actually would do that sometimes. They would go to their teachers and say, please tell me my worst faults. And my teacher said, well, you kind of already know what they are. So why don't you make a list of like your top ones, you know, and then start working on them? He said, this is actually in his book, Dharma Paths. If you read Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths, he tells you, make a list of all of your worst faults. Not all of them. Just for me, I would tell people the top three. Just go for your top three. I don't know how many he tells you to have, but you know, you get the picture. So I say, how about making your top list, right? And then begin to work on them. And what's good about this is that you'll know what your goals are, and you won't mind when people remind you you're falling short. Oh, like you were really mean to me, or you didn't consider my feelings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that when people actually point out your faults, you won't get angry. You'll just say, oh, that's number three, you know. And really, there's a lot of goodness to this. This makes so much sense, because then we get to set the goals. We get to watch and see how we're doing, right? And we get to make the corrections. So in a way, we're in charge of our Bodhisattva vow. We're in charge of our training. We're in charge of, of the follow-up and accountability. We are the accountability department. And so every day, we check up on our Bodhisattva vow in the morning and the evening. I also do it in the afternoon because I'm a little bit funny that way. And so what you do is when you check up on yourself, you rejoice in the good that you've done. Yay, me! I actually did something right. Yay! And may I do more of that. And if you do something that's not so good, it's like, boo! Boo me! I'm going to do better tomorrow. I'm going to do better next time. So in this way, it's kind of like, it's judgment, but not in a bad way. It's like acknowledging what we already knew about ourselves. See, this is why you make that list, because you already know. You kind of already know what the things are you need to work on, because people keep reminding you, you know. And so you already know about these things. So gradually you can begin to make strategies to correct things. So this is why we take the Bodhisattva vow. Because a lot of people tell me when they first start practicing meditation, their lives are kind of smooth. Everything is like, oh, well, this meditation is pretty good stuff. And then after a while, they'll come to me and say, I'm not entirely happy right now. And I'm like, why not? And they said, well, now I'm aware of my thoughts. I got to take responsibility for them. I hate that. As one person actually said, he said, I used to think I was a really nice guy, and then I started meditating, and I found out how much trash talking I do about myself and about other people in my mind. He says, and I got to take responsibility for that, because I'm eating that stuff, if you know what I'm saying, you know? And you are what you eat, you know? So if you're feeding yourself a lot of negativity, then that's what's going to be coming up. So we have to find a way to both take responsibility while being even-handed. Human beings don't do middle very well. I don't know if you found this to be true in your life. We tend to do black and white, yes and no, up or down, good or bad. We don't do like shades of gray and things in the middle. We don't know how to balance things. We're not good with that. Extremes we're good at, but middle we're not so. But that's what it takes to be a bodhisattva in training. You have to be able to be with yourself, acknowledge your faults, but at the same time say, I'm on the road to improvement because I'm talking to myself about this every single day. Because you're going in front of the Buddha every single day because he's your witness. The Buddha is your witness. So how am I doing, you know? And you then retake the bodhisattva vow in the morning and you retake it in the evening because there's nothing more worthwhile than encouraging our love and compassion. Encouraging and training in love and compassion. Plus, there are guidebooks on how to do it. There are guidebooks about how to be kind, how to be patient, how to be loving. They've got Shantideva, the guy who spoke 10 chapters, partly from the air in the 8th century. Shantideva gave a whole 10-chapter book on it. And so Pema Chodron, the American Buddhist nun, she did a fabulous book on this, and it's called No Time to Lose, where she talks about modern-day interpretations of Shantideva that are incredibly astute. And so these types of guidebooks are really, really helpful to us. I love it that Pema Chodron even takes Shantideva to task for some of his gender-based criticisms. He was an 8th century man after all. And she puts everything in perspective. And it's her commentary is really smart. I'll let you discover that for yourself. But anyway, there are guidebooks that exist. And plus, we have teachers and our Sangha members. We help each other with these things. And we help each other to learn about the Bodhisattva vow and to learn about the Bodhisattva commitment. And then once we take the Bodhisattva vow, we can actually train in it every day. We can wake up in the morning and say, hey, may everything I do today benefit beings in some way. Even if I make mistakes, may even that be useful to other people. And then we can learn compassion meditation. The Tibetan version of compassion meditation is called Tonglen. T-O-N-G means to send, and L-E-N means to take. Sending and taking, which is it's a variation on metta. In metta, you only extend love to all beings, but in Tonglen, you also extend compassion to all beings. On the out-breath, you give goodness. On the in-breath, you remove suffering from beings. And lest you think that suffering will harm you, my teacher in teaching Tonglen and in his book, Dharma Paths, he said, when all of that suffering that you're imagining comes to you, he said, it meets your bodhisattva motivation. Remember your bodhisattva motivation? It meets the purity of your bodhisattva motivation, and all that suffering just dissolves into nothing and disappears. Remember, only perfect bodhicitta can overcome evil. So these simple teachings can help us to apply ourselves to the bodhisattva path and make the bodhisattva path enjoyable even. At first, the bodhisattva path is a bit of drudgery, like, oh, you mean morning and evening, I have to look at what I've been doing and I have to take responsibility? Well, that stinks. But once you start doing it, what you notice is that you can do it. And you can do it without being harsh to yourself. Okay, maybe at first you're going to be harsh to yourself, but that's something you have to even be kind to yourself. You know, and this is, for many of us, is not easy, but training day by day, we actually have more kindness for ourselves, and we can realize that our mind can change in an instant. And if our mind can change in an instant, that means our habits can slowly change. That's what that's one of the great purposes of meditation. You're sitting in meditation and a thought comes up, and for a moment that thought like grabs your attention, and you're there and you're in the world of that thought, and then you realize, I'm supposed to be meditating. So then you take hold of your attention and you label what's just been happening as thinking, you let it go and then come back to the object of meditation. Maybe it's your breath, whatever. You bring your attention back and that thought that you were just in the middle of disappears. It's gone. It's actually gone. And what this tells us is that these thoughts are nothing of themselves and they can actually be dropped. And if they can be dropped, they can actually be changed because you can put something positive in its place. It's very interesting. The mind is amazing. And the Buddha kind of mapped it all out 2,500 years ago. But this is why the Bodhisattva vow is part of our training. It forms the basis for all the rest of the training we do in Tibetan Buddhism. It forms the basis for our mantra practice. It forms the basis for our nature of mind, Mahamudra practice. It forms the basis for our daily activities. You can actually like be washing the dishes and think, I'm going to benefit beings by washing the dishes. Okay, maybe you're only benefiting the family who's been yelling at you to do the dishes, but at least you're going to be doing benefit for somebody. And you can actually add to that benefit by saying, hey, may this all liberate sentient beings from their negative mental afflictions. So you can apply yourself in this way to all aspects of your life. So I'm sorry, I've been talking for a bit, and I want to make sure that you have time for questions. So we'll stop here for the moment and to summarize, saying that because we are what we think, we can train to put positive things into our mind and let go of the negative and destructive things in our mind. It is a step-by-step process that involves trial and error, but we get more patient with ourselves as we train. And using the training methods like metta meditation and Tonglen meditation and studying the Bodhisattva vow, we can learn strategies for how to accomplish that. So I think that's it for the moment. So we have two question microphones, so you can feel welcome to, you can either make a comment or ask a question. Operators are standing by. Okay, yes.
Hello, Lama Kathy. Can you talk a little bit about the motivation to reach enlightenment for the benefit of all beings and sort of how that is different in the Mahayana and if we're planning on taking the vow this afternoon, how we should think about that?
Yeah, okay, and this is, what's really interesting is that we want to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I appreciate you bringing this up because it was in the prayer. And I think that enlightenment seems like it's very, very, very far away because we start out kind of confused. And sometimes that confusion can be really thick. And we may sometimes feel a little hopeless because we can't stop doing things that are not helpful. But this is why we say the words every day, and this is why we train in this way. And in a way, even though Buddhahood seems to be so far away, we're doing it not just for ourselves. We're doing it so that we can become a source of strength for other people, which is really interesting because even if we don't attain Buddhahood in this lifetime, just by saying the words over and over again, just by repeating the intention over and over again, we make a pattern in our thinking that will aim us in a direction that's healthy for us, the direction of benefiting others. And at first, we're not going to know how to benefit others, and we're not going to know how to attain Buddhahood for their benefit. We're not, it's kind of just theoretical at first, but over time, we'll actually, as we practice, we'll begin to see like little bits of light at the end and be able to use that light to guide us and say, well, oh, okay, this worked, this didn't work, and I'm going to do more of this thing that worked. And so attaining enlightenment does sound like it's rather grand, and it could eventually, we may even think, oh, well, that's going to aggrandize my ego too much. Maybe I shouldn't. But we have to keep the twofold benefit in mind. That's what in Buddhist prayers they talk about, the twofold benefit, the benefit of oneself, that oneself is more free from suffering as one practices love and compassion. Oneself becomes more free from suffering. But then working toward it, we're actually working toward it for others. And part of the reason that this is helpful is that when we're doing something only for ourself, we might just be tempted to put it aside if it gets tough. I mean, for me, the big example is exercise. I know exercise is good for me, but sitting on the sofa is much easier. And so I might not be moved to do it. But if I'm thinking that I'm doing it so that I can live longer and be of more benefit to others, then I'm more likely to not give up doing something that's good for me. If I'm doing it because I see the suffering of everybody, I mean, how can you not? I mean, looking around in this world, how can you not see the suffering of all beings? Wow, it's like huge. And seeing that, we may feel at first like it's more than we can do, it's more than we can stand. But if we just kind of, what is it? Think globally, act locally. I think it's something like that, you know, that we can at least act with those people we're familiar with, the people in our own families or the people in our own circle. We can help them, perhaps. But I'm still not sure this has addressed your question. Did I hit it? Yeah, because I have a feeling there's a nuance to the question I missed.
I mean, I think that was a perfectly wonderful answer, but I guess what I was reaching for is the part of the Bodhisattva story about sticking around after you have attained enlightenment and for the benefit of all beings.
Okay, thank you very much. That fills it in. Okay, very good. Yeah, okay. Some people, you know, okay, so like, here's the deal. Some people say, what? I have to come back to samsara over and over again? I have a friend who lives in another state, and whenever I talk to her, she's like, I'm getting out of this world. I'm going to go to some pure realm, man. I'm not coming back here. This place is bad. Anyway, but everybody has their own ideas about that. But that's her personal idea. But the Buddhist idea is that, it's kind of like being an adult and raising a child, because the child has a lot of things that the child does not understand, and therefore they get angry about a bunch of stuff that they don't understand. But we're adults, and so we understand that eventually they're going to be able to deal with that. And so it doesn't really hurt us, you know, it does. What's going on, their big dramas don't really, I mean, we are amused by them and we may feel, you know, compassion for their suffering, but it's like not the same. And I think that's how the Bodhisattvas look at the rest of us. They're like, oh, they're so cute. They're adorable. Those unenlightened beings, they are adorable. I want nothing more than to give them a big hug and tell them it's all going to be okay. And I think that this is more like what it's like to be in samsara after you're enlightened. It's more like, I can handle this, because when a person is even a first-level bodhisattva, they're not suffering in the same way that others do. If For them, it's not that hard to be in this world because they know how everything works. They have a wisdom mind that knows how everything's built and how everything functions and malfunctions, and they kind of are okay with it. And so, I mean, here's the deal. The Buddha said, our minds were never created in the first place, so they can't be destroyed. So what are you going to do? What else are you going to do? I mean, what else are you going to do with your time? You know? Okay, all right. This is an old television show you guys probably didn't watch. Who's watched The Good Place? Yeah, okay. Well, if you haven't watched The Good Place, it's okay, it's corny, but I love it. They kind of go there in the last episode of The Good Place. Spoiler alert, cover your ears. In that when beings leave the good place, they actually kind of become one with the universe and then go around in like ways small and large, helping everyone. And that's really, to me, that's the Bodhisattva ideal right there. Is that, and if you read the teachings that summarize the sutras, people ask me a lot, well, why don't the Tibetans study the sutras in detail? Well, number one, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of them, and they are very repetitive, and they're very hard to understand. So they mostly study the commentaries that quote freely from the scriptures and explain the meaning of the scriptures rather than having us just kind of free study the scriptures. So in one of the scriptures, it talks about that when a person reaches this first level of bodhisattva awakening, they can actually emanate in 100 different places to do 100 different things for 100 different beings. So, and it gets better. And so if my capacity was expanded, that would be super. And I didn't have to worry about all the things I have to worry about now, that would be super. So I hope that's helpful, yeah, but slowly. I just think about the adult and child analogy, that helps some. Yes.
Thank you very much, Lama Kathy.
No.
I'm stuck on fear. Life is precious, but I think our society is changing. And life is being ignored more and more.
Yeah.
This is impermanence and going the wrong way. It's being stuck in samsara, and I kind of think that's getting more. So, yeah, I do do meta and Tonglin, but I feel not enough, more mental, internal. The threat, danger is outside, and loving kindness and compassion is not enough to protect our society.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I know it's really a painful observation to make, is that fear is incredibly powerful. I was reading some quotation from some great thinker of Western thought who was saying that fear is how you control other people. You make them feel afraid and then they do nothing. And I was thinking about that too, and that's kind of a painful thing to know. But at the same time, this is what we have, you know, and this is what we have. I think that I told the story last week or the week before of Trungpa Rinpoche when the communists were starting to kill people of faith. They wanted to mount an army to fight the communists, and they convinced him that he needed to lead the battle, and so they outfitted him with a military uniform and everything, and they were going to turn Trungpa Rinpoche, this great master, into a soldier. And at the last minute, he made the decision to throw it all away, and not to become a military person, because one of his close attendants said to him, killing another person is putting yourself in the lower realms for ages. And the worst that a human enemy can do to you in this life is kill you. But you yourself can throw yourself into lower realms for eons by choosing to kill another. So it's kind of a tough situation. Looking at the long term, when this is all we have to look at, the long term, that's where it gets difficult. Because then if we're only thinking about the short term, then it is pretty scary. But nobody can imprison your mind. That's the good part. Nobody can put your mind in prison.
One of my faults is to be self-centered and think I'm a hero. But it seems to me maybe going into the lowest realm because I kill or fight would be of benefit to others if the threat is great enough.
I think it depends on the motivation. It really does come down to the motivation. In the sutras, the Buddha describes that the only motivation, there's a story about a bodhisattva of the past who saw a bad person about to kill 500 people, and he killed that man. But he killed that man wanting to save the 500. But the other thing was, he was willing to go to hell for it. So I'm willing to go, if that's what it takes. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because of time, we'll have to stop. Unless there, I will take one more if there is one more. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Please. Yeah.
I think I remember when you were talking about Tonglen at some time. You said that. Are you actually removing or breathing in the suffering of others?
Right.
And you said it's purely imaginary. It's only
correct.
Internal.
Correct.
And so does that reconcile with this? If you're decentralizing and becoming less selfish by doing this practice, because you can feel it happening when you do that.
Yeah.
Is that how you're benefiting others and removing their suffering?
Yes, absolutely. You got it. Because as we train in love and compassion, we become more available to others. As we train more in love and compassion, we become more effective and more available to others. Because this also works on the fear issue, because one of the things that a person can do is they can actually do Tonglen with themselves. I'm going to go back to the previous question for a second, but then I'm going to expand on what you're saying. That you can actually do Tonglen for oneself and remove on the in-breath and accept the fear and breathe out comfort and healing to oneself. And you can do that for everybody who feels just like you and then for all beings in the world. Because I really fear for animals particularly because they don't have the capacity to work through these things. Some of them have more capacity than others, but I really feel for them because they have nothing but blind fear for their whole life, from the moment they're born to the moment they die and then beyond. It's mind-boggling to think about it. But going to what you're saying, Kempo Karthar Rinpoche basically said that when we do Tonglen, we're training ourselves to be more like a bodhisattva. And so even though we are not capable of actually removing the suffering from others, we, by training in this way, lose some of our fear and some of our selfishness gradually over time and increase our capacity for giving, and loving other people. So over time, it's effective in that way. I really appreciate you bringing that up. It's like amazing, right? And the whole path is genius in many ways, because as we're learning to let go on one side, we're learning to take hold on the other side. As we're letting go of selfishness, we're taking hold of love and compassion. So it's like it gives us a new purpose and means for being, because that's part of what's happening. Well, we'll have to stop here. I thank all of you for your thoughts and questions and for your interest in the Bodhisattva vow. As they mentioned earlier, we're going to do a Bodhisattva vow ceremony at 1:15 today. There's going to be a little break while we reset the room and so forth. So in any case, you can stay behind and watch the vow taking if you wish. It'll go for about an hour, maybe a little longer than an hour. So anyway, but you're welcome to, or you're welcome to stay and renew your bodhisattva vow if you've taken it previously. So something worth thinking about. So let's dedicate the goodness that we've accomplished here, and dedicate it so that all beings are free from fear and become Buddhas, and that they benefit beings wherever they go. We'll start with the words, "by this merit." By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thanks, everyone. Thank you so much. Okay. And thanks to the sound department. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.